You're listening to a new episode of Empathy Always Wins.
Philip, thank you so much for joining Empathy Always Wins. Just before we start the show, typically one thing I always ask for from our interesting and unique guests is to kind of to have them sort of talk about themselves a little bit to kind of give the audience much more of a perspective as to who they are and what they do before we kind of dive deeper into the nuances of the show. So Philip, the mic is yours. Thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really great to be here. What would you like me to talk about? Like my personal background and history or like about the company or about?
Absolutely. I'd love to just sort of dive in before we sort of dive in upon a Pontian.
Yes. So I'm originally from the UK, actually. I was born in the UK and then spent the first sort of 5 years of my life in South Africa. And then my father was a diplomat, so moved around a bit as a kid. Then was back in the UK, studied undergrad in the north of England, a school called Nottingham. Then did a master in mathematical finance in New York, Columbia University. Then I spent 5 years as a currency derivatives trader at BNP Paribas. So 2 years in London, 2 years in Singapore, and a bit of time in New York. And then I basically was in Singapore. I quit my job on a Friday and I moved to South Africa and I started working as an intern at a VC fund on the Monday.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I did that for like a year. Started to not be an intern after a while. Then I went to grad school in the US. So I did a joint MBA, MPA. The MBA was at Wharton and the MPA was at Harvard Kennedy School. In my summer there, also did some more VC in Kenya. And then immediately after that, I went to McKinsey in Dubai, where I was doing post-merger integrations. Some other kind of financial work. And then I started Apontia about a year and a half ago in Dubai. And we launched then in Saudi, Turkey, and Poland. We've got about 100 people split fairly evenly across those locations now. We basically buy and then grow e-commerce brands. So we've bought 10 brands so far. And the idea is, for the sellers, oftentimes they reach a point where e-commerce sellers in particular, where they've started a successful brand, but they don't really want to do the grind of scaling it, which is all the logistics, operations, sourcing, pricing, working capital management, all this stuff. And that's what we're good at. So it's an attractive proposition for the sellers, but we come along and we scale it. And then we give them some share in the growth in profit over the following few years after we've bought it.
I mean, that's quite fascinating. I think that you have, you've invested so much into your education and in multiple fields. Can you talk a little bit about like, were they intentional in you starting your entrepreneurship journey or was it just all a mistake or were you just following your curiosity? Because I think for many people listening to you today, it's almost like, what is this guy? Is he a mastermind of this or is it curiosity and it's just very fascinating to hear you say exactly how it unfolded.
I wouldn't say. No. To be honest, it wasn't really with an end in mind. It wasn't like a means to an end. It was like an end in itself, if that makes sense. So, I knew I wanted to go back to the US to do an MBA. So my first master's, I wouldn't really count because it was like a year-long master's. In the UK, you only do a three-year undergrad. So essentially, I've spent 4 years doing math, which is a bit like what you would do in a four-year undergrad in the US. My second master's, I was applying to... I knew I wanted to do an MBA in the US. And to be honest, just because I thought it would be like a fun and interesting experience, I didn't think it was actually going to help me that much with my career. And it was a really fun and interesting experience. So from that perspective, it worked out. But it also actually ended up helping me more than I expected with my career. So when I was in Singapore, essentially, I was applying to business schools. And that's one of the reasons I went to do VC in South Africa is because I was like, well, I can stay doing my job here and not learn anything for another year before I go to do my MBA, or I can do something a bit different and try and learn something. And so that's when I went to do VC for a year. But No, to be honest, it wasn't a means to an end. It was just, I thought it sounded interesting and cool. Yeah, and like the MPA at Harvard, it was like the classes in an MBA program are kind of dull. The people and the speakers and the social life are all great. But the actual classes are like tax accounting and, you know, marketing and stuff is not the market. Actually, I've got nothing against marketing, but it's not like, it's not like having bad appreciation of marketing, having started an e-commerce company. but it's not like the classes in Harvard Kennedy School, where it's like, you know, we had like the UN ambassador teaching one class about conflict resolution, or we had, you know, the leading expert on climate change teaching about, you know, new technology for addressing climate change, you know, stuff that's like actually properly interesting. So I honestly thought I can't think of anything I'd rather do than spend 2 years at Harvard discussing interesting topics with interesting people. So, and you know, there's a cost element and a time, what do you call it? There's opportunities cost and also financial cost, although there's some, you know, scholarships available. But my rationale was, I don't think on my dying deathbed I'm going to be like, I don't think I'm going to be like struggling to feed myself. So, you know, why not? Like, if I can find a way to pay for this, then I'll try and figure it out.
And I think the biggest thing that brings me to, you know, this next sort of dialogue between us is, I still can't crack how you launched Apontia. Can you walk us through that journey? I can. I think you've probably engaged with so many fascinating people. I've only been to Harvard twice for two events. Met the most fascinating people there. Can't imagine spending 2 years there. So, I like, where did it come out from? Did you spot a gap? Did you meet someone interesting in McKinsey while you're in Dubai? What was that turning lever point?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing I would say was very, very intentional is going to McKinsey. So I did know I wanted to do a startup and I wanted it to be a unicorn. Like, I was like, I don't want to like do a slow business. I want to create a really fast growing business. And so I did some research and I was, you know, like I looked at where most unicorn founders had come from. The majority of them have not come from traditional business, but of the ones that have come from traditional business. And by the way, this is a statistical anomaly that is often quoted. It's something along the lines of, the dumb thing that people quote is they say most unicorn founders didn't go to the Ivy League, therefore you don't need to go to the Ivy League to be a unicorn founder. And what they forget is, what is the sample size of all people who didn't, what is the percentage of all people who didn't go to the Ivy League versus all people who did go to the Ivy League that create unicorns? And the ones that went to the Ivy League have about a 500 times higher chance of founding a unicorn than the ones that didn't go to the Ivy League. So yes, it's not true that you need to go to the Ivy League to found a unicorn, but your chance of founding one if you do go to the Ivy League is about 500 times higher. So it's like, which one do you want? I'm not an education snob. I don't think they teach you anything particularly profound there, but like there must be something in the water or something that they're doing right to make that work. And, you know, so it mainly comes down to the network. But with McKinsey, I looked at all the companies which produce the highest number of unicorn founders per employee, and McKinsey is by far the highest. The next is Google, and the next is like Bain or BCG or one of the others. Google produces the absolute highest, but per employee, McKinsey produces the highest. So if you want to give yourself the highest statistical chance of founding a unicorn, there's a lot worse things you can do than go spend 2 years at McKinsey. And so that's what I did. And to be honest, that's exactly how we got the funding. So our first VCs were all, you know, were ex-McKinsey people. I got the idea because I was staffed on an e-commerce project and I was reading, there was a big article in the Financial Times about these e-commerce roll-ups at the end of 2020 about Thrasio and this. And I just wondered why it wasn't existing in the Middle East. I started having some conversations with VCs. To be honest, it took a week to raise a $3.5 million seed from scratch with no deck, no model, no, just like, hey, we know there's potential. Wow. here's how many sellers there are in the region. There's nobody buying. This is the multiple they trade for. We can launch this. And like any VC that sort of knows the model and knows whatever, they, you know, they're just in, like they didn't need much convincing. But what they were helpful with was putting me in touch with my co-founder Manfred, because I know about finance and acquisition finance in particular, and entrepreneurial finance, but I didn't know much about e-commerce. And so my co-founder Manfred is the like e-commerce guru who actually runs the business, runs these brands after we've acquired them.
How did you make a decision that he was the right fit? Because I think oftentimes you find really intelligent people or really, really, really competent people in one area, but in another area, you just don't know where to find your co-founder. So I think, you know, you almost made it sound very simple, but was it really that simple, or were you?
Honestly, it was, he has the perfect profile for what we do. And I'll say he picked me more, as much as I picked him. So it's not, I wouldn't pick, put it in unidirectionally. But I mean, the guy was the chief commercial officer of the biggest e-commerce company in Iran. Before that, he was chief marketplace officer of the biggest e-commerce company in Southeast Asia. And he'd founded his own e-commerce enabler. And he'd managed big teams of like, you know, hundreds of people. And the guy is like, has the perfect profile for what we do. So,
okay.
And like, yeah, we went for a drink and we discussed management styles and all this type of thing, and see if we get along and see how we'd do conflict resolution. And you're looking for a diverse skill, a founding team with diverse skill sets, and our skill sets pretty much as perfectly as possible complemented each other for this business model. Actually, there's one Y Combinator video which says, as a founding team, you shouldn't be looking for a great idea. You should be looking for the idea that best fits with your founding team's skill sets. And that is definitely true.
And I think you know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you guys had a record in your next raise. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, how did you guys do it?
Yeah, I think we were the fastest. Like, yeah, I think we ran from zero to a ton of money faster than any other company in the Middle East. So we raised $42 million Series A about 9 months after we'd founded. I mean, part of it, to be frank, is a function of the business model. And so we're acquiring. So really what we're doing, it's a bit like we're fundraising for a fund rather than we're, I mean, secondly, it's a combination of debt and equity. So it was $25 million of equity and $17 million of, no, the other around 25 debt, $17 million of equity. But even still, a $17 million Series A of 9 months after you've founded is still like super fast. But I mean, people just could see that there was potential. At the time, I will state this. At the time that we raised the Series A, and I'll give full credit to our Series A lead, which was STV, and also Rutted, put in, you know, were very helpful. But they backed us when we had almost zero revenue with this $17 million check. And, you know, that takes some conviction. So full credit to them. Now, you know, like 11 months after we've done the Series A, we went from zero to having $15 million run rate revenue in November. So it's paid off, but it was, at the time, it was, in hindsight, maybe a bit of a risky bet.
A very big risk. And I think one thing a lot of younger people maybe listening to this show are asking, what is it that VCs are now looking for, especially after this bubble kind of burst? You know, a lot of people are going after growth, almost blitz scaling at all costs with very poor unit economics. I mean, you've obviously done two kind of, I would say, historic from the region standpoint, two very historic raises, whether it's the 42 Series A or 40 whatever Series A, or if it was the sort of 1 week raising a 3 million seed. That's just very, very, very difficult to turn around. But given your average Joe with a very unique idea that has a quite significant market, what's one thing you would guide?
I would say you need one of two things. You can't do it without either one of these two things. You need either an extremely credible founding team or a lot of very convincing traction. If you don't have either of those two things, it's very difficult to raise now, particularly now. So for us, I'd say we were as credible a founding team you could have. So Manfred had already founded and built a successful company. He'd already worked for big e-commerce companies. Lazada, one of his companies, exited for $3 billion. On my side, I knew a lot about acquisition finance. So I'd say we were that. We didn't have any traction at that time, but I mean, for the Series A, we had a bit of traction. If you don't have a super experienced founding team, they're not going to back your idea without traction. So then you need like just a bunch of traction, basically.
Which basically no code can be an amazing solution. And I think one thing I want to touch upon, Philip, you mentioned something that, you know, you simply said on the fly, but it was like, what the hell? To me, you went from like 0 to 9 months and you scale, and now you're at 100 employees. As a leader, how do you handle that effective management style without chaos and stress? What is there?
I like your presumption that there is not chaos and stress. ample amounts of chaos and stress. So I mean, it's more a question of how do you deal with chaos and stress rather than how do you try and scale without chaos and stress. I don't have an extremely good answer for that. Besides, actually, I listened to this amazing podcast with Charlie Munger the other day. Do you know Charlie Munger, who's the...
Absolutely.
He said something along the lines of, the biggest mistakes anybody will make in their lives are when they forget what they're trying to do. And I completely agree with this. So for us, the biggest mistakes we've made when we focus on things that are not relevant to the business, like, for example, we have a messy like breakup with an employee where they're unhappy about something, or where they like this type of thing happens. If we get all hard-nosed and like say, okay, we're going to go to court and blah, 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 and all this stuff, that's not what we're trying to build an e-commerce business. So at some point, you have to just put your principles behind you if you think you've been wronged and be like, it's fine. We'll settle on whatever terms you want. The same thing can happen with sellers in our case, but that's not what we're not going to be successful or not successful by squeezing a millimeter out of somebody here or there. Where they're trying to squeeze us and we give in, sort of thing. So it's very important to just remember what the core thing you're trying to do is. And for us, that's build a house of e-commerce brands that consumers in the region love.
Do you think that when you're going at such a fast pace, you get so many pulled in so many different directions that the hardest thing to do is focus, right? The hardest thing to do is to focus on that one sort of unique winning North Star that you do not deter. It's almost like running a sprint Usain Bolt. I was a professional swimmer in for all my life, you know, I just quit a few years ago, and I was a sprinter. And the coach would always tell me that the moment you look, because I was a fly at 50 and 100 meter, the coach always used to tell me the moment you look right or left, you've lost the race. So the moment you kind of actually, because it's you're playing in the game of milliseconds, and whether you're a startup or whether you're, I think, you know, a fast growing venture, I think it's almost similar to this analogy, or what I'm understanding from you is quite the same. Do you find the way Middle Eastern startups respond to fast-paced dynamics efficient? And what do you think needs to scale in the mindset of entrepreneurs here in the region? And I'm not to say that it's a downward look at entrepreneurs here. No, I'm talking about your experience having multiple markets and almost in an empowering way.
Like you say, I wouldn't say that entrepreneurs in the region are fundamentally or systemically any different from entrepreneurs anywhere. You know, I think the trap of falling into, so as much as people like to say it, people often say startups, the good thing about joining a startup is that it's not political. And I personally think I disagree with this. I think startups can be, and often, you know, and in almost all cases, invariably are pretty political, because there's not much like governance already in place. And so there's often jostling for position, this type of thing, even if you've got your head down and you're really powering through. And it's so important to not get consumed by the daily office politics and the daily this, that, and the other, and just remember what you're trying to do. I think that's what I'm trying to get at. And I think that that advice applies to startups in the Middle East as much as it applies to startups anywhere, really.
I think you mentioned governance. Governance is something that I think we have a step, a step to kind of really tackle that here. I think governance here in the region for majority of startups are very poor. We've seen that. Even though I am a huge fan of Swivel, I'm a huge fan of many other companies without naming, dropping. But I mean, I love Swivel. Swivel's CFO is one of my backers at Empower. But you're seeing so many different things happening to so many companies, and I think I genuinely think the structural governance is poor at a very large scale. We've seen many things blow up here, and I think I truly hope that we can understand that moving forward, especially for the younger folks out there that think it's almost a quick win or a get rich quick journey when it's far from that. I think looking at what you've done and seeing how you're able to kind of pull 3 million in a week, or in 9 months pull your Series A. I mean, this is the accumulation of all the work that you've put in till this very point. And I think that it's very easy to kind of headline something without context. And I think we as younger people, we're very impatient. And that's part of why I personally feel very passionate about doing this show, is to actually bring some context to the table and bring some spice. Before we wrap things up, Philip, what is your take on leadership, and how do you see effective leadership in today's day and age?
I don't want to sound like a parrot, but I think it ties back to what I just mentioned now about keeping your eye on what's important. And there's a professor at Harvard called Professor Heifetz, and he's always talking about the work. And if you keep the work at the center, then that's when effective leadership comes. And I think I buy into this a lot. I also buy into the notion that leadership is a choice, and pretty much anybody can be a leader if you decide to be. I'm not a big believer in, if you're some charismatic or particularly, I pretty much think anybody can be a leader. You just have to decide that the goal that you're pursuing is worthy enough of you putting your time and energy, and building a group of people around solving this challenge that you're trying to solve. If you decide that, then anybody can be an effective leader.
Philip, before we wrap up, I love Harry Stebbing's show. I always do this quick fire round. There are two questions. First of all, what's your favorite book or podcast, and why?
I love the Joe Rogan podcast. It's
brilliant. I love it.
It's so interesting. It's so diverse. I learn something new every time on it. Like, I love Joe Rogan. I think he's amazing. That's the person I really thought about that question. I'm thinking myself to give that answer, but I've listened to a few really good ones recently.
Yeah, so. No, Joe is he's a very woke individual, and I love the way he sees life, and
I don't understand why the left seems to lambast him every so often, but I mean, I consider myself to be fairly liberal and fairly left-wing, but he's, for some reason, the left doesn't seem to like him, but can't really understand. He seems fairly liberal to me. But
yeah, I think we live in a day and age where cancel culture is very real. And I think, when you just find a concentrated group of people not liking you for some reason, they appear to be a lot bigger than they actually are. But I don't think they actually are that effective in stopping. I think Joe Rogan's popularity and his impact is way bigger than the people who don't. I just think that for some reason, the agenda of people not liking him is just, it appears to be a lot bigger. But I think one last thing I want to ask you, Philip, before you wrap this up today is, what's one thing you wish you told yourself, your 15-year-old self, that you wish you knew now?
My 15-year-old self was extremely lazy and bad at schoolwork. And and I only really became conscientious and hardworking in university. And I did it. I have an identical twin brother. And when I was like 18, he got into Oxford and I didn't. And then I went to visit him in Oxford, and I was like, oh shit, I like to, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
I was like, oh shit, I fucked up. Like, I should have actually been trying it all this time. yeah, I think I would have told myself to get my head down, and you can't see what's out there unless you sort of look up a bit. And I didn't have any, you know, role model from my school or anything like that to look up to at that point. So I think I'd have told myself to open my eyes to what's possible at that age.
What's out there for you, Phillips, in the next 2 years? Where do you see what are your ambitions in the next 2 years or 3 years for Pontia?
In the next 2 years, well, we're going to raise the Series B right now, and then we'll launch new countries, essentially. So probably Egypt next, Pakistan, Nigeria on the cards. The idea is to scale this thing. We've proven it can work, and now we're just going to keep growing.
Amazing. Philip, I loved having you on. Your story is quite unique. Your perspective is very unique. Our audience haven't heard that perspective before. Thank you so much for being on. And I genuinely appreciate all the work that you're doing and what you're bringing to this region. I think it's very inspiring. And I'm sure our listeners are going to be very happy with reaching out to you via email or finding you on LinkedIn. And thank you.
For sure. Thank you for having me. And I think you're a very sort of engaging interviewer, so keep it up. And it's great.
Do feel free to share it with your friends. Drop us a rating on Apple. Subscribe to the show. Follow it on Spotify. And we'll see you soon in a new episode of Empathy Always Wins. Take care and have a lovely day, guys.